welcome to the Healer Chronicles. I'm your host, Autumn Martin. Today, Dr. Laurie Watson joins the Healer Chronicles to discuss the importance of sexual health. Our conversation is a little spicier than usual, so this is an adults-only conversation today. Just a disclaimer in case little ears are around. Dr. Laurie Watson is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex therapist, certified in emotionally focused therapy, a certified addiction specialist, and has 30 years of experience working with couples and individuals about love and sex. She's also the co-host of the podcast Foreplay Radio, Couples and Sex Therapy. She's an author and popular blogger for WebMD and Psychology Today Online. She's the director of Awakenings, a multi-site counseling practice for couples and sex therapy in North Carolina. Sexual health is an important part of healthy marriages, our physical health, and emotional health. I want to thank Laurie for sharing her wisdom with us today. Here we go. Well, Laurie, welcome to the Healer Chronicles. I'm so excited about this conversation today. I have told our listeners a little bit about you, but if you wouldn't mind just telling us who you are, what you do, where you're from, and giving us our listeners a little bit about your background.
Sure, I would love to do that. And thank you for having me. I am very excited to talk with you. Dr. Laurie Watson, I have my PhD in sexology, and I'm a certified sex therapist. I'm also a licensed marriage family therapist, which is really my first calling. Sex became a subset of what is important to me about relationships. And then, of course, I learned a lot as I went along. And I work in North Carolina. I have several sites where we have therapists who are trained like I am trained, and we all do sex therapy and couples therapy together. I have a podcast called Foreplay Couples and Sex Therapy. It's on iTunes. And so you can kind of find us wherever you find podcasts. And I have a co-host there, George Fowler, who is my couples therapist co-host. And together we kind of attack the sexual attachment cycle and the emotional attachment cycle in coupleships and try to help people find really secure bonds.
Yeah. And it is, it's ranked in one of the top 10 on iTunes under sexuality, right?
It is. It's number 4.
That is awesome. Well, it is really good. And for our listeners, so Laurie and her husband are family friends of ours. And we ran into them a few weeks ago and learned about the podcast. And it has been, it is definitely something I wanted to listen to by myself in the car. If there is a disclaimer, like, you know, not kid friendly,
not kid friendly,
but it is so good. It is really good. It's not, I mean, it's educational, it's informational. The balance between, the discussion about just sex and then also couples therapy. And one of the acronyms that I love that y'all use that I'd love for you to tell our listeners about is best sex.
Okay. Well, we can start there.
Yeah.
Best sex is just a way to think about your sexual experience when you're seducing your partner or your partner is initiating sex, and then what happens during sex and what happens in the afterglow. And B is for body. So what does your body tell you? What are you feeling in your body? E is for emotions, or really our heart. You know, do we feel connected to our partner in those different stages? S is for spirituality, because many of us do have faith-based traditions, and others of us who don't still feel like sex is something that we become bigger than something than just ourselves. And then T is for thoughts, erotic thoughts. And so what's happening in our mind? And we ask people just to use that as a way to talk to each other. That's the whole point of the podcast, is getting people to talk to each other, to be responsive to each other, so that you can more deeply understand how your partner feels about the sexual experience, how there's an overlay with our heart and emotions and our spirit and our thoughts. And we try to get people to just use this. It's such a great tool for a conversation, to maybe ask your partner, You know, tell me, when we're getting ready to have sex, what does your body feel? You know, and sometimes our body feels nothing, and that can be really normal. And it doesn't mean that we don't like or want sex. It just means that our body takes a while to wake up, you know. And maybe, what do you like in terms of emotional connection? Do you like to have emotional connection first? Or does sex give you that sense of closeness and safety so that you feel more emotionally connected afterwards?
Yeah. One of the things that you and George have said on the podcast is that talking about sex sometimes can be more vulnerable than sex itself. And I think a lot of us were raised to not talk about it, especially if we have a faith-based background. You know, it just was never discussed. And so it feels taboo to even have those discussions. And I do think, so I think that a lot of people listening to this are very familiar with couples therapy. A lot of people are encouraged to do premarital counseling, or when there's a stress in the marriage, to go to couples counseling. Or we even have friends that do just management, you know, like, hey, let's just check in and let's have a counselor and see how things are going. But I don't think that a lot of people think, oh, we need to go to sex therapy. So how would you say, is there a difference between the two?
I think that's a brilliant question. And I think sex therapy, when you first hear it, sounds a little scary. Like, oof, you know, we don't talk about sex with anybody. It's such a private place in our lives, such an intimate area. So thinking about going to a sex therapist really conjures up ideas of somebody who's, you know, wearing flowing gowns, just like meet the Fockers, you know, and it can feel really anxiety producing. But good couples therapy includes sex therapy, because our relationship, in order to have the tightest bond that we can have, we need to be connected in our hearts and our bodies. So our emotional connection and our sexual connection is imperative to make a bond. And I think that a good couples therapist will always bring up in the first one or two sessions, you know, how is your intimate life? Because oftentimes one person feels that a little bit stronger in terms of that's how they get connected. So if we don't talk about it early in therapy, that person is completely missed and not validated. So we have to talk about it right away, which is, you know, we don't necessarily have to say everything we do in bed right away, but we do have to talk about the force that sex exerts on the couple's relationship.
Yeah. Well, and how does somebody know, how does a couple know, or an individual know that it's time to initiate that? I mean, would you encourage them to look for a quote unquote sex therapist, or would you just encourage them to look for, you know, a couples therapist who will make that a priority in the discussion?
Right. So I'm sold on a particular type of therapy. It's called emotionally focused therapy. And it's very experiential. So what happens in the therapy room is kind of the healing agent. And of course, we don't have sex in a therapy room, and there's no sexual touching or touching between the therapist and the clients ever. That's totally taboo. But in sex therapy, you know, you might Google a sex therapist, but they wouldn't necessarily have the theory behind them that I think is so important, and that's attachment theory. Mm-hmm. So I would say first go to emotionally focused therapists, and then look for a subspecialty of sex therapy, or go to somebody that has a lot of experience in that mode, and tell them I'll consult with them for free. Because those are my people.
Yeah. Well, and then what do you think a couple that comes to you, what should they expect from that first experience? Because I do think, I mean, I know that, you know, and people that I've talked to, I think if you have any sort of background in counseling or attending for yourself, you kind of have an idea of what to expect. But if somebody went to a sex therapist, what would they expect to discuss? I mean, I know you mentioned a little bit about that first, but how would that differ?
Good question. So as a sex therapist, I want to know about the force of sex on their coupleship. You know, does one person feel more desire? Is their partner responsive to that desire? Responsive is not necessarily meaning I want to have sex just as often as my partner does. But when the person who maybe has the higher desire lifts their eyebrows at their partner offers them a smile back, and there's a loving connection. That's secure sexual attachment, even if we have different levels of frequency and desire. So I'm checking for that. Is the sexual connection secure? I want to know, you know, just a few things like, well, what happens if one person wants it a lot more? Or what happens between the two of you if your partner says, you know, I really would like it to be, have more variety? You know, how does the partner respond to that? Eventually, I'm going to ask them questions that are pretty explicit. You know, I want to make sure that they are both reaching climax. And I just do want to check in on, you know, are there any discrete sexual dysfunctions like premature ejaculation, or maybe the female doesn't reach orgasm? And so I just want to make sure that I know what's happening, because that helps me gauge also the body part of their sex life, the level of pleasure that they're experiencing. In secure attachment, there's two motives. One is for body pleasure, and the other is for heart and emotional connection. And sometimes people have other motives to have sex, like, you know, I have a headache, or wait, you know, I need to go to sleep. And so, I want to have sex just to get to sleep. And, or the other person is like, you know, I'm feeling kind of anxious about whether you're attracted to me, and I just want to initiate sex to make sure to feel really solid about that. Those are not bad motives, but they can become motives that tire out a sexual cycle if one person wants it a lot more often than the other person. You know, if one person is saying, yeah, I need sex every night to go to sleep, and their partner is kind of a lower desire person, that's not going to work so well. So I'm checking out explicitly what they're doing. I'm checking out how the sexual attachment cycle is working between the two of them. And I'm watching just to see how comfortable they are. I'm very comfortable talking about it. I don't expect anybody else to be very comfortable talking about it, but I'm looking for warmth, or I'm looking for tension that is about sex between them, not necessarily just talking about sex.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that you and George talk about on the podcast is you use the terms pursuer and withdrawer. Can you explain what those two different kind of...
Right. That is where it's all at, because sex is a cycle. So we think that we have sexual problems that are discrete, you know, that one time it wasn't very good. Another time my partner just went through a season where they wanted it so much more and I didn't, and all this feels kind of uncoordinated, but actually there's a pattern to our sexual problems, just like there's a pattern to our emotional problems. One person has more push. Oftentimes they want more intensity, more connection, and they feel it in their body. So they are usually the more frequent initiator. They often are more creative. They bring ideas to the bedroom. It can be very positive, but sometimes that person, when they're frustrated, it kind of goes to criticism, frustration, more anger. The person who is the sexual withdrawer, now it may sound like they don't like sex. They often do like sex, but they like it when they're ready for it, when they feel comfortable, when the setting is right, when they feel connected. And so the withdrawer, though, with the pressure of the pursuer, tends to pull back. You know, you ask me something, you always want sex. You're always asking me for it. I'm starting to feel pressured. And so they shut down. Rather than that lovely smile when their partner suggests sex, they turn away and they, you know, they are like, oh, I'm too tired. And they start to send negative messages back to their partner, who in turn starts to feel frantic about the sexual connection and ups the ante in terms of their initiation and their pressure, which of course makes the other person feel controlled, suffocated, pushed away. Their one often defense mechanism is their libido shuts down. And then the person who has the higher libido I don't know that their libido increases, but they certainly increase the ask. You know, it's like, well, gosh, I got to get up to bat, you know, five times before I'm ever going to get a yes. And so they start to ask more and more and more, which of course adds to this terrible negative cycle. It really has nothing to do with native desire or their love for each other, but their sex life gets tanked by what we call the negative cycle. And you have to think about that almost as an entity outside of the coupleship. Couples, if they think the other one is the enemy, you're pushing me too much, you deprive me too much, I'm drowning in your requests, you're starving me. But really, it's this negative cycle, and we can see it as the enemy, and we can team up against it. And that's how we heal our sexual problems.
So is the goal for both both partners to be pursuers?
Oh, that's every pursuer's fantasy, Autumn. But no, they can be whatever style that they want. What we want is that the pursue and withdraw actually moves toward the middle so that they have some security. You know, we may natively be more pursuing or withdrawing. That may be part of who we are. That comes from our childhood and our attachment styles from childhood. But what we want couples to do is learn new moves and flexibility rather than criticizing and pushing. You know, the pursuer often hears, okay, so I just want to ask for it, right? I just want to ask for it. And then it's supposed to happen. I've tried that. It doesn't happen. And that's true because there's implicit pressure. Actually, vulnerability is the way out of the negative cycle and what we encourage both the pursuer and the withdrawer to do. The pursuer to open up and say, look at, you know, I need you. My body needs you. I feel so much safer after we've had sex. I just feel our connection in such a deep way. It lasts with me. I have joy when I go to work the next day after we've had sex, that deep sense of being with you. And when you say no to me, I start to ask inside, am I not attractive? Do they not want me anymore? Are we on the rocks? Are they with somebody else? You know, all these doubts come into my mind. And I just got to tell you that so that you know what's happening inside me. Yeah. And the sexual withdrawer likewise can be as vulnerable too. Say, ooh, you know, sometimes after we make love, you ask me, was it good? And the message I hear in my head, I know you're just trying to check it out. And if I'm pleased, but the message I hear in my head is that it's not good enough for you. Mm-hmm. And that I haven't made you happy, and that there was something much more that you were looking for. And that just shuts me down. I think, well, you know, it was beautiful. It was fine. And then when I tell you that, you like want more from me. You say, I don't give you enough words to explain myself. And the whole thing feels fraught with tension and pressure. And I just am afraid that when we make love, I'm going to have a fight with you afterwards. So I don't even want to go that direction. That's what I'm going through on the inside. And do you see how vulnerable that is and how that can untangle things?
Yeah. Yeah. My husband and I always joke, and we tell young couples this too, that, you know, we were both raised from, you know, faith backgrounds, and mm-hmm. just one talking about sex was like inappropriate. And then you go from sex is bad and you should never do it to now you're married. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay. And for that switch, it doesn't just switch automatically for a lot of people. And so he always laughed at me because I remember like on our honeymoon, I was like, what are you thinking? What are you thinking now? Well, what are you thinking right now? He was like, I'm not thinking anything, you know, but a lot of that cycle that you're talking about of kind of that processing and wanting to be validated and wanting to know that you were good at it and that, that you were like the attachment, you know, that emotional bond was there and that there wasn't anything that you did to hurt it.
Right.
And in regards to, I think most people would agree that sex is important for marriage, but what would you tell people as far as sex being important for emotional health or even our physical health?
So, right. The research says that sex is imperative for a romantic relationship to feel secure. And by the way, I was at your beautiful wedding. I remember you all very well. It was a gorgeous day and so much love was present. I was really honored to be there. But what would I say in terms of how it helps our own emotional and physical health? I talked with a young woman who had never experienced an orgasm. She had been married for 12 years. And to me, anorgasmia is what we call it, not being able to reach climax. And that's a really easy fix. And we solved that in 4 sessions. And she said, "Oh my gosh, Lori, it is such stress relief. I have never felt such stress relief." I mean, just that experience, which of course an orgasm releases oxytocin and dopamine, and that makes us feel good in our mental health, in our bodies. I mean, physiologically, it is stress relief. It is very important. I mean, I don't want to say that, you know, not doing it means you're going to have poor mental health, but I think it can really contribute to our own physiological relaxation and stress relief.
Yeah. Well, and most of us don't talk about sex. I mean, I think too, a lot of young women and get their sex advice from Cosmo or from, you know, other different magazines because their friends aren't talking about it or, you know, they don't have mentors in their life that are talking to them about orgasms or, I mean, the fact that like, you know, you had to step in as a therapist to say, we can take care of this in 4 sessions. Like, I don't think those conversations are happening. So how do we, as a generation, as a culture, get to the place of where do we get that information from so that there aren't women out there that are married for 12 years and don't know what an orgasm feels like or don't know how to have one?
Right. This is really how I got into sex therapy. Was I was a premarital teacher and trainer, and I saw the need in young couples for sex education. Most of the couples came back because of sexual problems when they came back into therapy. And that's not what you expect from honeymooners, right? We expect it to be just great. The culture tells us we live in a very sex-saturated culture. There is sex everywhere you look, Instagram, movies, Facebook. I mean, everything points to that sex is easy and natural and should be always very exciting. But the reality is the sexual relationship needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
Nobody says that. And there isn't good information that is given sort of run of the mill. I mean, I would love for the churches who are teaching premarital classes to include at least one day on sexual functioning so that young couples, even if they have made a decision to be together before they get married, oftentimes they still don't know, you know, a lot about what happens sexually. I would say particularly for young women, there's so much pressure. The way it looks in the movies is really not how sex is for her. The way it looks in the movies is that they fall in bed together, and without anybody really stimulating her or touching her, she reaches climax in about 90 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes up against a rough tree. I mean, it's just, it is not the reality. Most women need about, and this is going to blow people's minds, but most women need about 20 minutes of relaxation of what I call sort of a mind shift. They're leaving their everyday world, their everyday activities, the list. So many young women have the list of all the things they got to get done. They got to leave that behind. And that takes about 20 minutes just to leave that and come into the sexual moment. And that means that they often need just time laying together, cuddling, long stroking, you know, slow arousal. And then most women need about 20 minutes of clitoral stimulation to reach orgasm. That's a long time. And the movies make it look like that isn't even necessary. And it makes it look like she climaxes very fast. Most women do not climax with sexual intercourse. I want to say that again. Only 15% of women out there can climax with sexual intercourse. And of course, that's just not what we think. We think that everybody should do it that way. That's the way we're put together. But that's not actually true. The woman's clitoris is the center of her sexual universe. Those are the nerve endings that correlate with the male penis, but it's in such a smaller space that she's actually more sensitive and delicate and often doesn't like to be touched right away until she's aroused.
And where would be the best place for, because we always encourage young couples, you know, you've got to do premarital counseling. You've got to do it. My husband won't even officiate a marriage, you know, for anybody if they mm-hmm. haven't met with him a few times. But where would you say is the most, you know, one of your best places to get the sex education into the hands of young marrieds or newlyweds or those that are engaged, kind of getting ready? And also to couples that have been married and are hearing this for the first time and going, oh my gosh, I've never heard that before. Maybe it's not that something's wrong with me, but we didn't know what we didn't know.
Yes, absolutely. I talk to people all day long, Autumn, who have been married for 12, 15 years, and they didn't know what I just said.
Yeah.
I've talked to people, men particularly, who have, you know, hit their foreheads with their hands. Like, why didn't I know that?
Right.
I thought that that's how she climaxed. And you mean she might not have been climaxing this whole time? Oh my goodness.
Right.
And so I mean, obviously I need to advertise my podcast, Foreplay Couples and Sex Therapy, but because we have episodes for newlyweds, we have several on honeymoons and virgin sex. And, you know, most women are afraid that being a virgin and having sex for the first time, that it will be hurtful and painful. And in the episode, we really talk about ways they can prepare their body. So that's not true, that they can have enjoyable sex. So, I mean, certainly I'm out there.
Yeah.
And they can look at that. There's several episodes I really recommend in terms of understanding the sexual cycle. I think it's about number 209 is when George starts with me and we really hit this dynamic and we hit really explicit ideas like how to solve premature ejaculation, how to solve ED, how to have an orgasm. So that's there. I don't, and as you're saying this, I'm like, I need to do a premarital video. Yeah. So that, you know, we do a premarital training for couples. Emotionally focused therapy, there's a weekend called Hold Me Tight, and it's offered all over the country. And that's for the emotional attachment cycle, and some of them are also for the sexual attachment cycle. So it's Hold Me Tight, Hold Me Just Right. And they go into the sexual attachment a little bit further. I think what we need is a segment on sexuality. And I would say George and I also do twice a year a weekend called Great Love, Great Sex. And we talk very explicitly about the sexual anatomy and physiology and how it all works together and how emotions are a part of that, how couples get stuck. So you can find me at foreplayradiosextherapy.com. And George and I do that. I think we're doing the next one on May 20th in the spring. So that's a weekend that is just kind of devoted to your sexual relationship. So I would invite listeners there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am taking notes. I'm going to put all of that information in the show notes as well, so people can link to it. Because I just think it's, you know, for those of us listening that are like, oh my gosh, I just want to share this with everybody, you know, that those are great places and they're just as important as doing premarital counseling to be able to kind of carry those and hold those both. Cause you want to be able to give couples the best, you know, the best help, the best advice so that they're not just their sex life that can be great, but their relationship can be great as well. And are there, how do you think that there are ways that couples, you know, in addition to these conferences, can grow in their comfort level together in just talking about sex? You know, we talked about how just talking about it can be vulnerable. How can couples grow in their, because I feel like it has to be like an really a muscle that's exercised to be able to, yes. This isn't comfortable for me to discuss. And they may not want to jump straight into explicit things that they like or don't like, but where do they begin talking about that?
So I would have couples talk about several things with each other, beginning with their history. Like, what did your parents teach you about sex? And sometimes parents didn't say very much, but they lived out a life that felt romantic. Or sometimes they lived out a life that wasn't affectionate and you couldn't really tell if there was much connection. Because what we live in front of our children is 60 times as powerful as what we tell them. If we live a romantic relationship with our partner, our spouse, that's what gets translated to our children. So that's the first thing I would have them share is just, what did you learn growing up? You know, and some couples have not shared their sexual history with each other, and that would be an anxiety producing conversation. So I'm not saying they have to do that, but they might want to give an overview of particularly things like first experiences. If they feel comfortable and safe sharing that, a first experience is like an imprint. And it's so important. And many men have much better first experiences than young women. You know, and that's ubiquitous and tragic. I would say, I think I heard a stat the other day that 80% of young women who their first sexual experience is not so great, whereas 80% to 90% of men have a good first experience. And so I think talking about that, I would also ask them to maybe start talking about sex in four parts. So this is when we're getting ready to have sex. When I start to feel desire, this is what I like. This is how I like to initiate. This is how I like it initiated to me. My husband and I, we were also in a faith tradition growing up and had all kinds of questions when we got married as well. That was part of what drove me into sex therapy was like, ooh, I really got to figure this part out. But I know that we initiated in the ways that felt comfortable to us and we really missed each other. I think I was more of a toucher, you know, and he was more of a words person. So he would talk about it and that would leave me a little cold and I would touch and he wouldn't necessarily feel as comfortable and maybe my timing was off or, you know, so we kept missing each other even, and we had never talked about it. How do you like it initiated? Well, how do you like it initiated? I mean, that simple conversation kind of really helped us. Yeah. So what happens in that early initiation stage, then I would have them, as they grow in comfort, talk about, you know, the things that they think about that arouse them and what is it like for them to have an orgasm? Do they always have orgasms? Are they communicating that? If they don't, I would say, you know, maybe say, well, I listened to this podcast with Autumn Martin and she had orgasms and that most women don't have them through sexual intercourse. And I thought I was really odd and, you know, maybe there's a way that we can get me there, you know, something like that. So I always say blame the podcast, you know.
That's right.
Way to bring it up. And then
I might have a lot of friends asking me to go out for coffee after this podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and we've hit on it a little bit just in talking about the things that women didn't know. But what are some other myths about sex that you think women believe that they believe that they just have either never known or had never been told otherwise? One, there's a scene in a movie. It's a Diane Keaton, Mandy Moore movie where the mom is like empty nester. Her daughters are getting married and she's in her 60s and she's asking them what an orgasm feels like. And her daughters are like dumbfounded because they're like, what do you mean? You know? And so it's this really sweet, spicy moment between a daughter and a mom of the daughter having to educate her mom what an orgasm is and how to get there. And so, you know, I don't think that myths are just out there for, you know, 20-year-old women. I think that they're out there for generations. And so what are some of the things that you hear?
Yes, I think that's so true. And I know the movie. I like the scene as well. Yeah. It's so cute. So, I mean, I think this is it, that women believe that their body should warm up quickly, that their arousal pattern should match their male partner. So let's think about that. A man could be watching his wife come out of the shower naked and have an erection. So he has completed his arousal cycle. He is ready to have sexual intercourse, and he could probably climax in 2 to 8 minutes. So this woman who's just come out of the shower may not have even thought about sex yet that day. So her arousal is going to take much longer, much, much, much longer. And I think that women tell themselves, I'm inadequate. I don't work very well, because they don't match a male arousal template. But the reality is, you're female. I had a young woman come to me. She was in college, and she had gone to her gynecologist, and she had said, my gynecologist sent me to you, but basically has prescribed hormones. I said, well, why is that? She said, well, I told her that sex is painful and that I don't really get anything out of it. I said, oh, okay. Could you tell me what happens? And she said, well, oftentimes, you know, I'm at my boyfriend's apartment and he comes in and we just lay on the bed and we start. I said, what do you mean you start? He says, well, he's ready. We have intercourse. I said, okay, well, that would hurt. Yeah. And yes, you would not get anything out of it. Yeah. That would be a normal experience for a female. It doesn't mean you need hormones. There is nothing wrong with you. Mm. So, I mean, definitely they need to know that their pattern is normal and natural, and that they need a lot of attention. Most women need a lot of connection beforehand too. That's kind of the way they're wired. So being able to communicate that in a way that, and set it up with some creativity, you know, like let's make a plan. I often think the American date night is a setup for a sexual failure. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, couples do this at the, maybe Friday night, they're exhausted. They get the babysitter there. It's rush, rush, rush. They get out the door. They go have a big dinner. Maybe they have a glass of wine. By the time they get home, they have indigestion and they're exhausted.
Yeah, we actually have friends that make a point to have sex before the date because they know that that's how it's going to feel afterwards. And,
amen. And
so they send their kids off early and then they give themselves, you know, an hour beforehand to be able to do that. And I was like, that thought has never occurred to me. That's brilliant. You know, I think another thing that happens too with women is that part of that arousal cycle is that, especially after children, I don't, maybe even before children, but we don't feel good in our bodies again. Not to mention the fatigue, and we just, things aren't as perky as they were whenever they were 20 years old. And so, you know, it's hard. I think sometimes with women, we wrestle with, why would you want to do anything with this, you know, where their partner is not thinking that, you know, their partner is thinking, I love your body. I want to be with your body. And women,
and men are often so visual. They want to see their partner naked. And if a woman is feeling a struggle in her body self-image, it you know, it's a setup to miss each other.
Yeah. Are there any tricks or anything for women that are listening to this of going like, that's me, you know, that's like, I want to pursue my husband. I want to be able to kind of match where he is, but I just don't feel good in my own skin, but I know it doesn't bother my husband. Are there things that you tell people in order to kind of help them overcome some of those initial, I mean, that's not like a one session kind of thing, but that start to make them help progress in those areas?
Autumn, you are hitting on something that is so important. I think that resentment over an unfair shared household load and body self-image are the two killers that shut down women, young women. So, I mean, I absolutely talk to women every day who just say, you know, I'm not that happy with my body. I can't see this body as sexual anymore. I feel so anxious about sharing this with my partner and letting him see me naked, even though he says, and is very reassuring, he wants to see it, wants to see it. I do love George talking about that all the time, you know, that men want the lights on, they want to see. And they love their partner. And I think that most men love the partner that gave them children and, You know, they can see the breasts that droop and still find them lovely, and they can understand stretch marks. And, you know, it's the enthusiasm and responsiveness that of their partner that kind of imbues their body with sexuality, not necessarily the perfect form. I think that women need to do a couple things. One, practice in prayer or mindfulness to just like really set aside time that you clear your mind, because there are so many messages of negativity about who you are that somehow or another your body is not good enough. So really work on that. Like if those thoughts come, work hard on pushing them away. The other thing is when you're in the moment and you start to feel self-conscious, first of all, self-consciousness wanes as we become more aroused. So maybe in the beginning, yes, you're under the sheets and you're not quite comfortable, but please, as you become more aroused and feel a little braver, come out of the sheets and let your partner see you. And a trick can be pulling a Kegel squeeze. So squeezing your Kegels is basically a movement, right, that focuses your energy on your pelvis. And it's very, very hard to think about much else, including cellulite or my belly or whatever else, when you are holding a Kegel squeeze. So it's a way that I tell women, you know, suck your soul back into your body with a Kegel squeeze.
Yeah. And I loved what you said earlier too, about leaving the list, you know, as part of that 20 minutes of, you know, mind relaxation and doing that mind shift. I think that that is crucial because that list never gets any shorter. Mm-hmm. And for me, the only time the list goes away completely is when I'm on a beach somewhere. We learned, you know, pretty like halfway into our marriage that the only way I would truly, truly relax and become what we call vacation autumn was to go on vacation. Like, mm-hmm. cannot happen at home. That list still in part stays here, you know, mm-hmm. and is ever growing. And for some reason, men, I'm not going to say they don't have a list, but it seems like their list doesn't occupy their mind maybe as much as they, and I don't want to like overstate, that's not like a broad statement. I think men's brains are wonderful.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think part of the difference is testosterone. Testosterone is a focuser. And so men are better able to compartmentalize. So when they're in the sexual moment, they are sunk into the sexual moment. Women have less ability to compartmentalize. So that's why these thoughts kind of invade them about, well, what about the children? What if the children wake up? What about the list? I got to get the laundry done. I got to go downstairs and do the dishes. It's like they're going a million miles an hour. And it is really partly due to the blessing of testosterone that men don't do that. So you said something important though. You said vacation autumn is able to really, really let go of the list. And so what I say to people is, can we get vacation autumn once a month?
Right.
You know, can we make a plan so that once a month you leave your children, you leave your home? So many women who are young, married, parenting small children, they, you know, they just don't feel as sexual at home. So I say, you know what, save the date night money. Don't go to a big fancy dinner, go to a hotel where nobody's going to hear you, where you don't have the pictures of your children on the wall, where you can go at 3 o'clock, take a nap, take a bath, and meet your partner downstairs for appetizers, then go upstairs, make love. And then what? Send your partner home to relieve the babysitter and you sleep in until noon on Saturday.
God, that sounds amazing.
I have never spoken to a young woman who says I'm exhausted and have low libido who doesn't say, you know what, on that night, I would have energy for sex. I would want to have sex because I would get the rest beforehand. I would know that more rest was coming. I would have a little bit of space and time to myself. As a woman, being penetrated in sexual intercourse is invasive. I mean, it's a beautiful, loving, wonderful thing. But psychologically, if you've given everything to the children, everything at work, and you have no time left for yourself, it's very hard to be invaded. It's like you need to have a little bit of autonomy. And so I suggest this exercise once a month to couples. And if they could have wild, hot sex once a month, and then they have sex that is nourishing and nurturing and ordinary the rest of the month, most people would find themselves much, much happier. I'll bet you they would stay out of a sex therapist's office.
Yeah. Well, and two, I think a lot of people that listening, you know, you accumulate points on your credit card or other things. And so sometimes there's literally free money to be had. And we've actually encouraged, I don't know where it was we were listening to this or we heard it, but it wasn't even a full weekend away. Like the hotel was the date night, you know, it was literally just away from the house. And then they came home later that night, you know, and like, if you truly can't, depending on what, you know, what is going on with your family life, or if you don't have social support that can come in, like maybe you can still find a babysitter for 3 hours and you go and use some hotel points and then you come back, you know, like that's a solution too.
Exactly.
Well, what about some myths that men believe?
Well, I love that too. So first of all, men believe that they should have an erection easily, that their erection should last for the entire sexual experience, and that there should be no faltering. And you know what? That is a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. Because most men, you know, especially once they reach about 40, 45, you know, they really need some additional touching and stimulation to have an erection. And so that's a big surprise. And most men have incidents of ED, you know, along the way, and it freaks them out. I will say George has gotten through to me like, Lori, you know, erections are kind of everything for men. And you have to see how anxious they become when it doesn't work. Right. Or if they climax too fast, they tell themselves, I'm a terrible lover. Mm. But what happens, what makes them, what makes the moment so terrible is oftentimes the man withdraws with a sense of humiliation. So what does he do after he's climaxed? He feels terrible about himself. He tells himself he's awful, that he didn't please her, and he gets out of bed and goes into the other room. And she's left there, potentially still aroused, and feeling rejected. Like she interprets his anger at himself as frustration at her. And this disconnect happens over and over and over in couples' bedrooms. So, you know, he needs to know, you know what? Premature ejaculation is pretty normal. About 40% of men experience it at some point in their life. Also pretty fixable. And that beating yourself up afterwards is actually part of the shame cycle that causes it to happen again. It's fixable. Let's get it done. That's like 6 months of one time a month sex therapy can fix ED.
Yeah.
In 6 months.
Well, and I know in my training, I was taught that, you know, the first questions that you need to ask is what kind of stressors are going on in your life? You know, if a man comes, or a lot of times the wife or the partner will bring the man to the office because they won't come by themselves, or they'll come with some like, oh, I have an earache, but also I'm having trouble with an erection. You know, it's never like the actual issue that they present with.
Right.
But the first question we always ask is, well, tell me what's going on. Like, tell me, what does work look like? Are you the primary breadwinner? Did you get laid off? Are you feeling stressed from that? Or, you know, how old are your kids? You know, like, are you going to have to pay for college? Like, what are all the things that are swirling? Again, like we go back, like men still have a list, right? And so sometimes those lists can be overpowering and can contribute to that. And then the other part of it is, I also do want to know from a health standpoint, like cardiovascular wise, because sometimes ED can be related to, are you taking blood pressure medications? Mm-hmm. You know, like, are you, let's kind of look at the full, rather than just hone on my erection is not happening, or it's not happening the way that it should. Let's look at kind of that cause and effect.
Men should always have desire, and that we don't take into account that they are emotional beings too, and might need connection, might have stressors that are interfering with their desire, might be so pressured about the finances or their job that they kind of give it all away at the office. And then when they're home, they're exhausted. So that, you are absolutely right that men believe that about themselves, And women believe that about men, that men always want it. And then secondly, erectile problems are complicated. And I tell men, if they're in their 40s and they're carrying about 15 pounds on their belly, that is, and they're starting to have erectile problems, that is their body's very important warning that this is the first sign of cardiovascular problems, that cholesterol is plugging up basically the capillaries in their penis and causing them to not be as hard. There could be other problems too. It could be valve problems, whatever. But, you know, I often ask them, what's your cholesterol?
And those are valid. I mean, those are like very, very valid questions. And those answers are very important. And it might, it might get them out exercising, you know, like it might really go, oh, I haven't had my cholesterol checked in a while. And heart disease does run in my family. And it could definitely be, you know, be multifactorial as far as what's going on. Well, and that brings me to another question that, so in, you know, in my line of work, I deal, I am just right smack dab in the middle of chronic illness and disease all the time. And I see how that affects caregivers. I see how it affects relationships. I see the strain that it puts on those things. So where is the role of sex and intimacy in the in that place of illness and chronic disease?
It is so important. So I my dissertation was on breast cancer and helping people survive breast cancer sexually as a couple. And I think, first of all, we've got to remember that the person who is suffering with the chronic disease may still feel desire. They may still need that reassurance of lovemaking to bond, to feel connected to their partner. And oftentimes the caregiver is struggling in a different way. Sometimes they don't want to burden their partner with their needs, their sexual needs. They say, oh, you know, my partner's already suffering. I don't want to bring this to the table. Or they can go into burnout, right, as caretaker syndrome. You know, I don't see my partner as a sexual being anymore because I'm there doing all these caretaking things. First, I would say, as hard as it is, couples need to have the discussion about what sex means now and what they need. And especially if the caregiver or the partner of the person who is struggling with disease and things like that needs to say, you know what, I still do have sexual needs. Oftentimes, especially with breast cancer or prostate cancer, couples are not even told how that's going to impact their sex life. Yeah. The doctors are just trying to save their life. And nobody's saying, oh, by the way, he's never going to have an erection again.
Right.
You know, probably. And she's like in shock. Like, what does this mean? What does this mean for us? You know, because that it's discovered on their own. So first, as medical, you know, practitioners, we need to do a much better job of communicating the sexual impact of medication, of disease states. Most disease states, people can stay sexual for a very long time. I had a friend whose partner had MS, and she said to me, you know, Lori, the one thing that is working is his erections. And this is the one place that makes him feel like a whole being, a real man still. Can you help me? Because everything else is failing. And I want to be there for him in this way. It was such a beautiful thing that she could see that and that as a couple, they could talk about it.
Yeah, because when everything else is just kind of being stripped away and you don't really feel like a whole person, that is just so crucial to have that, you know, to have that conversation. You know, and I'm also reminded of another movie clip from As Good As It Gets, where Jack Nicholson is like actively having a heart attack. And they're saying, you know, have you taken anything else? Because if you've taken, you know, Viagra or anything like that, it could stop your heart. And he immediately sits up, you know, yes, I did. You know, but that is, but even, you know, even in aging, you know, do you meet with many couples that are like 70s, 80s and still like have a vibrant sex life? And how is that possible?
Yeah. So Autumn, this is my peer group. So yes, I meet with people my own age and 60s, 70s and 80s. Absolutely. We have a friend who is 80 years old. He is playing tennis every day, very handsome. His body is built. And my husband and I always look at each other and say, let's age like him, because this man is super hot.
Right.
We know he and his wife still are romantic and sexual. Absolutely. I mean, sex, I think if anything becomes more vulnerable and deeper between us as we age, there can be age-related complications. But one of the things we can do when we're young is learn this communication pattern of talking about it. And flexibility, I say, is sex insurance. You know, maybe it's a little harder to get aroused. Maybe there are ED problems, but knowing how to work around that and be with each other. And, you know, sometimes sex may look a little different. Maybe it isn't the hot, wild sex of the movies, but it's loving. And maybe one time one partner has an orgasm and the other doesn't, and then they take turns. You know, I mean, I think the idea is, can they stay connected in their sexual attachment? And my vote is absolutely they can. I talk to lots and lots of people who are vibrant, who have good, solid desire still. I mean, I know when I was young, you know, the 60s looked old, but let me tell you, it's not old.
Well, and what would, you know, what would you say to those that are listening, kind of parting advice for those that have been married maybe five plus years and they've got toddlers, you know, what is some advice you could give them today on November 6th to kind of spice up their sex life today?
It's our number two episode on sex and parenting. You know, people are so concerned about how do I do this? I mean, first of all, I would tell you, the marriage has to come first. It absolutely has to come first. Your children will be more stable and more secure if you and your partner are number one. And I know that just flies in the face of people who say, but our children have so much need. You know, they're only little ones. And I'm like, well, yeah, but they're only little ones, but they're going to need you to be connected when they're teenagers and when they leave for college. They're going to need you to have a relationship and a romantic relationship. So please don't put it on the back burner. Romance is for now. And so I would say again, how can you prioritize time to be together and making a plan? I mean, we think about couples who are dating and it may look like sexual attraction and energy was very spontaneous, but actually they set aside enormous amounts of time and planning, right? They would go on a date. They would set aside 6 hours from 6 o'clock to midnight or whenever to be together. They would dress up. They would put their best foot forward. That takes creativity and planning. So I would say to young married people with children, I know it's hard. I really do. I've lived through it. I've raised three children. My husband and I kept one night a week as an inviolable commitment to be together. Every single week on Tuesday night, we were alone together for 16 years. I went out when I had a fever. You know, I went out when my children had fevers. You know, I mean, you have to prioritize and make a very solid commitment. Be intentional about it, because those are the most unhappy years statistically and the most difficult to stay together. But the consequences of falling apart are really that your children become unstable. So, you know, we think that purchasing all the toys and the lessons and everything is what is really going to make our children happy. But let me tell you, parents who are connected to each other make children very, very happy.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good truth that people need to hear, especially just when they're bogged down in the fatigue and don't feel like, when a date night or time with their spouse doesn't feel like it's a priority.
Let me say one more thing, and yeah. I don't know how spicy this sounds for your audience, but definitely investing in vibrators when you're young and don't have much time can cut down on both of those 20 minutes of arousal, the slow arousal and reaching orgasm. I mean, a vibrator can get a woman there, you know, in a matter of minutes. And when you have Tuesday night and you're exhausted and you've got about 9:30 to, you know, 9:36 before you fall asleep, you know, that's probably enough time to have an orgasm, to get connected. And it's okay to have quickies for a period of time or as a staple to keep sex alive, to keep your bodies connected. And that way she's having orgasms too. We need orgasms to feed desire. So I would say, you know, I think it's probably more now, but it used to be 60% of all American women own vibrators. It's really, it's not as spicy as it sounds. You know, it's very common. And if they want to come to my website, I think I have some on there that are listed, but I'll just say it. It's new sensual. It's about the size of a lipstick container and it's very powerful. It's very non-discreet, or it's very discreet, and you know, it works. So try that as an alternative to finding 45 minutes in your day.
Yeah. Well, and I'll put the link to your website as well in our show notes. And there might be a lot of women getting that in their stocking this Christmas. That's great. Just throwing that plug out there.
Right. I will send you the link. I think it's on Amazon now. It used to be very expensive. And I think it's only like $18 on Amazon. So I don't get any money for that. That's a free tip.
Sure. Well, and the other thing, one of the things you always talk about in your podcast, and this is always something that my husband and I tell every wedding that he officiates, we also always sneak lubricant into like the guy's suitcase or something and be like, you don't know what you don't know. Just trust us. And I think that could be, I mean, you talk about this a lot on the podcast that, you know, people don't know or they don't use it, but can you speak to that a little bit about why that's important and helpful?
Oh, yeah. I think lubricant should be used early in the sexual experience before he even touches her or when she's touching him. It just makes it so much better. It makes the touch so much better. If you touch a woman before she's aroused, she's going to be dry. It's not going to feel good. So use a lubricant. I do recommend UberLube. I have, they are a sponsor for us. So I want to talk about that, you know, but if you say, use the coupon Foreplay, you get 10% off. So they are my sponsor, but I have been using and recommending UberLube for 20 years before I did the podcast. Okay. Because it's a silicone-based lubricant. It is so smart. It's thin. The temperature is just right. It melts to, you know, body temperature on contact, so it's not cold. It doesn't get gummy. There's no allergies. It doesn't create infection. I mean, it's a really smart. And I'm so glad you and your husband recommend that to young married couples, because anxiety can create, you know, a lack of lubrication in a woman in a heartbeat. She may be lubricated and then she's not anymore. And it's simply because she just had one little anxious thought. So yes, use lubricant.
Yeah. And we could probably do part 2, part 3, part 4 of this conversation on the podcast. And I am going to definitely refer people to your podcast, because there are so many great episodes, specifically in regards to, like, whenever you even brought up vibrators. I think there's such a stigma in so many people's minds of, like, you do sex one way and that's the only way. And any other way, we're not going to talk about it. That's for the movies. And, you know, if we are participating, or if we are using a vibrator or using whatever, then sometimes there's that sense of, like, shame that goes with that. And I do think that your podcast has been so great at speaking into those places. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that y'all do say is there may still be things that y'all talk about that you're like, that's just kind of a hard stop for, you know, for someone, and that's okay.
Absolutely.
But it also gives, I guess, permission to ask the questions of, I've never thought about that. And I always thought that was taboo. And I feel like, am I supposed to feel shame or guilt for even having those thoughts? And so I would really encourage people to, and the great thing about your podcast is you name each episode very well. So you can kind of scroll through and be like, oh, that sounds interesting. You know, and you don't have to go in sequential order. And, exactly. And it highlights just so many different areas that I think are so helpful for people that are looking for just really knowledge. And just like you called it earlier, just sex education you know, for both our physical health, our sexual health, our emotional health.
Right. And I would just say to the shame piece, you know, there are things that you can try and do. And if it adds to your love for each other and it makes the experience more pleasurable, that's a great thing to try. You know, there should be a blessing in that. And, you know, if your partner wants to do something and it's a hard stop for you, it's fine. You should not do something that feels bad to you, painful to you, or just taboo to you. You don't have to try everything, but you do need to communicate with your partner about that and maybe explain to them why it feels that way so that you're in conversation about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then next question, what parting advice would you give to those of us that have teenagers? Because I will tell you, first of all, we thought it was hard to have sexual intimacy and a great sex life when our kids were little, because we never thought we'd been more exhausted. But now they don't go to bed. And then you have to go pick them up at 10 o'clock. Or they're playing video games and you can hear them all night long.
Yep.
It's like nobody prepared you for this season.
That is so true. So first of all, I would say sound machines, like get a sound machine in your room and turn it on every single night. And it doesn't matter that, you know, what they think. Also, get behind a locked door. You know, make sure you have a lock on your door and on your bedroom door. And also make a ritual out of, you know what, mom and dad, Friday night is our night. We go upstairs. We bring the pizza upstairs. We're going to watch movies and hang out. Don't come knocking unless there's blood. You know, so that they get accustomed to the idea that parents have a right to privacy. They have a right to quiet time. They have a right to be by themselves in their own home. You know, so teach your children young and certainly by teenage years, do it every week. So they're not like, oh, you know, mom and dad are going to go have sex or something, you know, because teenagers will think about that and they don't want to think about that. But
right.
If it's a ritual, if you've always done this Friday night pizza, y'all have pizza downstairs, you can, you know, watch movies or whatever, but bedtime is 9:30. You get in bed by yourself. Mom and dad, we are going upstairs at 7:30. You know, don't knock.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes
it's an in-home date night.
That's right. And sometimes I think it gets to the point where we start threatening. We're just going to tell them what's happening. And then maybe they'll actually leave us alone.
That is so true. They would definitely leave you alone.
They'll never know.
I mean, I think
the
they'll get the hint when you say, you know what, we're having our in-home date night tonight. And so don't come and disturb us unless truly, you know, the house is on fire or somebody cut themselves, and don't you dare cut yourself. And, you know, and this is just, it has to be part of the program. It has to be that parents have time alone by themselves in their home, especially if they can't afford to go out that night. And sometimes we just need to be in our own home. That's where we feel relaxed. I had a girlfriend, I'll end on this. And she used to say room time is at 9 p.m. Period. And every kid had to go to their room at 9 p.m. She said it didn't necessarily mean bedtime, but everybody had to go to the room, stay in their room, except to come out to go to the bathroom at 9 p.m. Because she said, you know what? I got four kids. I need time with my husband. I'm done. I'm done with kids by 9. My kids, you know, she tucked them in when they were little, but by the time they were like 10, she's like, you know, it's up to them when to go to bed. I've kissed them goodnight. I've read them a million stories all their life. You know, that's when they could do their homework or whatever. But she let them become autonomous about their bedtime. You know, and I think this was actually pre-computer. So nobody was allowed computers in their room in her house.
Yeah.
So it's different, but.
Yeah. Well, and then lastly, what parting advice would you give to those that are in the glory stage that you're in of empty nesting right now?
Woohoo! Yes, it's so great. I mean, we really, I think, you know, we went through a transition. It was difficult to like redefine our roles. And then after that, it was just like, oh, there is so much peace. I mean, we really do get to pick up and go whenever we want. We do get to have sex whenever we want, wherever we want in the house. And I would just say, you know, these are the days that you can spend a lot of time together reconnecting. And I think having rituals helps every couple, but I know my husband and I, we set aside particular times. Saturday morning is ours. We go to coffee, we have sex, you know, we're together running a few errands, and it just makes for a really pleasant weekend, a way to start the weekend. So I would say, what is your ritual? You know, where are you finding time to connect? And make that, you know, a really solid plan.
Yeah. Well, I love it. I think this has been so full of wisdom and education and help. And, you know, I want not just my friends, but our listeners to talk about sex in the same way that we talk about, you know, getting an annual physical or getting a mammogram or getting, you know, now people are starting to talk about mental health. You know, I think it's health is a journey, and, you know, and we all have one. And I really want, as a provider, we have got to create spaces, to where we educate people and we invite them into those places to ask the questions that they don't feel like it never was safe to ask before. And so I just want to thank you so much for this conversation. And I will definitely put the link to your show and some of the different things that we talked about, the conferences that are coming up, some of the episodes that we referenced, and then also some of the fun toys that we also referenced as well. So Merry Christmas 2021.
You're welcome. Is that what? You're welcome. No, right. Thank you. Thank you, Autumn, for having me. And I think that what you're doing on this podcast, I know you're educating in many different ways, and it's so important. And I really appreciate that you took an hour to talk with people about this subject that is so important to their love, so important to the bonds between a couple, and, you know, really adds to the stability of families and eventually our society and culture. So it's, you know, we got to get sex right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Laurie, and we will talk again soon.
That was such a fun conversation. I hope you gain new insights and knowledge for your own relationship. Please share this episode with friends who would also benefit from this crucial sex education. Please check out and subscribe to Foreplay Radio with Dr. Laurie Watson and George Fowler. And check out the show notes for other links, including Laurie's book, Wanting Sex Again, and Awakening Center. Remember, what is shared here should not be taken as medical advice or opinion. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show, and share with your friends. We all have a health journey. Live well.